So all moot point. Okay, so my name is Ken Shen. This is work I did with Lars Bilston here over the past like year and a half or so. And it was actually just accepted this morning for publication, so I'll put it on MasterPH this afternoon sometime. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the thermal stability of accreting white dwarfs, the accreting layer. And you might ask yourself, hasn't this already been done several times? And you would be right. This has been done in the past, and this is just an example of that. This is a plot from Nomoto et al. 2006, and it shows that there's a very, this is accretion rate versus mass of white dwarf, and it shows there's a very narrow range of thermally stable, of accretion rates where you get stable hydrogen burning. Okay, so it's a very narrow range of about a factor of 3. What I hope to accomplish in this talk is to explain as clearly as possible why you have an upper bound, why there's a lower bound, and how you get stability in between. And it'll turn out there'll be two channels of stability. Also, I'll try to give you a sense of why there's this factor of 3 that's almost constant over the entire range of white dwarf masses. In addition, it's not fully agreed on that there is definitely this range of accretion rates, which is the only range you can have thermal, have stable burning. There is a recent paper by Starfield et al. 2004, which claimed to have stable accretion all the way down to 10⁻⁹ solar masses per year. So this is the whole range they got. And this was for a 1.35 solar mass white dwarf. The question is, why is this so vastly different from the previous literature? Was it because they were accreting onto a hot white dwarf, which might explain it? Was it possibly because they were implementing a full nuclear network with a bunch of isotopes? Maybe something in there was doing it. Okay. In general, why do we care about stable burning dwarfs? Well, they show up as super soft X-ray sources, and there's someone in the room who knows something about that. And those are intrinsically interesting. They're very bright sources on the order of 10 to the 36 to 10 to the 38 solar ergs per second. So they're really bright. They're also interesting in that they're likely progenitor scenarios for type 1As. So I'm sure everyone here knows this, but you need to get up to the Chandrasekhar mass, and a very nice way to do that would be to accrete from a companion star. The problem being that there's this very thin range of accretion rates, which is stable. So if you want the white dwarf to grow, you need to be able to burn your hydrogen stably without having nova explosions. And also in general, the stability of shell sources is important. Shell burning occurs in other places like post-Magnetogon stars, red giants, AGB stars, where you have shell burning around the core. So we'll explore how those are stable as well. Okay, so what's our plan? The plan is we're going to solve for the steady state first. Okay, and by steady state, I just mean that we're processing the material out of the envelope as fast as it's being accreted, so that there's some envelope mass which remains constant, and you're coming in at the top, and you're burning at the bottom, and it's just processing through. So we'll solve for the steady state, and we'll need to know the composition. So this is the hydrogen mass fraction, metallicity. Those will matter for how you burn. It'll give you your opacity as well. Clearly, you'll need to know the mass of the white dwarf or whatever star you're doing, because that determines gravity and radius, etc. Accretion rate, fine. And also the core luminosity. That B stands for base. So it's the core from below, the luminosity from below, and that will help set thermal conditions. So you solve for the steady state, and you just perturb the entropy equation. Okay, and you'll find temperature perturbation, pressure perturbation. There's also density perturbation in the burning term. And you'll need to find a way to relate the density and pressure perturbations to the temperature perturbations so that you can solve for the time scale and see if it's negative, so the perturbation will decay and be stable. Okay, so we're just going to solve for the steady-state solutions. Just set the derivatives to zero, time derivatives to zero, and you find that burning equals cooling. Okay, pretty common sense, right? This is an approximation. We're saying that the the burning mass is just the mass contained within a scale height. This is an approximation. It's what we really want to do is integrate epsilon dm, but we can't do that analytically easily. So this is just an approximation. It'll lead to some error, but we've got to start somewhere. In steady state, this is the burning luminosity. It's just this is what's going to give you your change in luminosity from the core. Okay, so it's just your accretion rate times your hydrogen mass fraction and the energy you get from burning that. Fine. Okay. So now we have to specify how you're burning. So you specify the energy generation for these white dwarfs. It's probably the cold CNO cycle, which I'll talk about in a second. Specify a form for luminosity, equation of state. You close your system of equations, and you can just solve for the temperature and density at the burning layer. Little side note, this will be important. You can write your luminosity for radio diffusion this way. Okay, we're assuming Thompson opacity, and it'll be self-consistent later. But this is just the Eddington luminosity, right? And here you have the ratio of radiation pressure to total pressure. Okay, so you can just rewrite this in this form. This is beta is the ratio of gas pressure to total pressure. So 1 minus beta is the radiation pressure to total pressure. And this is just the Eddington standard model. The important point being that if you want to raise the amount of radiation pressure you have, you have to get closer to the Eddington limits. Okay. I should define this. Nuclear Eddington accretion rate just means when the burning luminosity equals the Eddington luminosity. So the closer you are to Eddington, the more radiation pressure you have. Okay, so here are steady-state solutions for white dwarfs, which are burning via the cold CNO cycle. And just to refresh your memory, in case you don't remember, these are the nuclear reactions that get you four hydrogens into helium. For the cold CNO limit, what this means is you're cold and diffuse enough such that the rate-limiting step is this nitrogen-14 proton capture. So all these other reactions can be approximated as happening instantaneously, and your burning rate is just the rate your proton capturing onto nitrogen-14. So it makes the analytics pretty easy. So here are steady-state solutions. This is temperature density space. We'll just pay attention to the solar metallicity lines, which are these two. Okay. The squares are a lower mass white dwarf and a higher mass white dwarf. The accretion rate here is 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year, and it goes up in accretion rate that way. The main point, besides proof of principle, is that there's a very narrow range of temperatures. We're in log space, but it's not much of a range here, right? Whereas you're going over several orders of magnitude and density. And that's just because the cold CNO cycle is a very temperature-dependent burning rate, because it's T to the 10 or T to the 12, depending where you are. Another thing to note, for the low metallicity cases, is 10 to the minus 2 solar, okay? So a little ridiculous, but you can you start bumping into this regime where you can't approximate this as just being the cold CNO cycle anymore. You have to start taking these other reactions into account, and that'll motivate later work. Just for reference, this isn't new work. This has been done a long time ago, 30-something years ago, by Sinkovich, and these are the same lines, and it agrees. That's good. Okay. Okay, so now we have the steady-state solutions. We can solve for the temperature and density and pressure perturbations. Okay, and we do that. We need some way to, relate these things. Okay, and we could do it by assuming homologous expansion and contraction, just scale-free, so that dr over r is a constant in the envelope, and that's what some previous people have done. But instead, for our situation, I think it's more appropriate to just integrate out hydrostatic equilibrium, and you can solve for the envelope mass. And then we just demand that the envelope mass stays constant during the perturbation. And that's, that's fine as long as the perturbation time scale is shorter than the accretion time scale, and it is. So that's what we do. As a byproduct, so we're solving hydrostatic equilibrium. You specify the temperature of the base, you just integrate up until you get enough, the mass in your envelope. What this gives us is this upper bound on the scale height. So you can't have an arbitrarily high scale height at the bottom, because that's determining where the top of your layer is. At some point, your scale height gets big enough that the top of your layer is out in infinity, and you can't get any higher than that. So the temperature isn't changing much because you're burning cold CNO. So what this equivalently is a constraint on the amount of gas pressure you have, or how low the amount of gas pressure you can have. Okay, so it, it's in a, go ahead.
There's
always going to be some noise, right? So just any small, we've solved for the steady state, but we have no idea whether it's unstable or not. So any small kick could, if it's unstable, just, grow. What I did was solve for perturbations in temperature and relate the other ones to that. But it's just, if you perturb your temperature a little bit, does it go away from equilibrium?
Right. Well, what I was thinking was that one possible perturbation is,
the mass accretion rate is not really exactly steady, then that would influence the assumption that you gave that the envelope mass is staying. But I guess what you're doing is more general, so let's do that first. Yes, although I don't think perturbing the envelope, the accretion rate will matter much at the bottom, because by the time you're bottom, I think it's pretty steady state accretion. But I would need to think about that more. Okay. So there's this constraint on the scale height, which is equivalent to a constraint on how much radiation pressure you can have. Essentially, you can't have too puffy of an envelope, otherwise you're ejecting mass out at infinity. And so remember, you can relate the radiation pressure to the accretion rate via the Eddington standard model. And so you have the sub-Eddington upper limit to your accretion rate. Essentially, it's the same physics as just the red giant luminosity core mass relation. They have additional helium burning because it's a red giant, but it's essentially the same physics. You can't have an arbitrarily high luminosity because you're ejecting. You can't solve hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay. So this is just showing these two lines. This is the nuclear Eddington rate, and this here is the real constraint. So whereas naively you might think you can accrete all the way up to here, you in reality can't go higher than this. You can't go higher than this line because you can't solve hydrostatic equilibrium above that.
That is because of the method that you're using, or is it a real constraint? Because the hydrostatic equilibrium is something that you just assume you don't calculate.
Sure, and so as long, what you need to be making sure is that your perturbation is longer than, sound travel time across your envelope, but it's orders of magnitude much longer.
So it's the assumption is always an assumption.
Right, exactly. So it's not, really an assumption.
It's an assumption that this condition is always.
Okay, so we're able to relate the density and pressure perturbation, the temperature variation perturbation. We can just solve for whether or not it's stable. Okay, it turns out that there are two channels for stability. In this first case is when you have a thick shell. So when you're close to the upper bound, you have a very puffy shell. And if you solve just, thermodynamic equations, what happens is you put in some heat here, okay, and it turns out that you actually get more expansion work done than the heat you put in. It has to draw that from somewhere, and it draws it from the internal energy. So you actually put in heat, and your temperature drops, which seems a little funny, but, just think about stars. This is exactly what happens with stars. As they contract and cool, and they're radiating energy out, they're heating up. That's just, they have a negative, what's called the gravithermal specific heat. It's just the virial theorem, right? So, so they're like the ultimate thick shell. They're very thick. There's no shell at all. And so you can go in there with, as Lars likes to say, you go in there with a blowtorch into the center of a star and you're heating it up. What happens, the temperature drops and the whole thing puffs out. And if this weren't the case, then we'd all be in big trouble because the sun would have, exploded a long time ago. Right, and so another thing to note, this is independent. It doesn't care how you're burning or how you're cooling. They set the steady-state solutions, but this is purely just a stellar structure argument. It's just hydrostatic equilibrium. So, this is just a stellar structure stability case. So that's for the thick shell close to that upper limit. And this dashed line is just showing where this becomes negative. So in this range here, you're becoming stable via this negative gravithermal specific heat. Okay, the other channel for stability is when you don't have a thick shell anymore. Okay, and so this is the case where you have a thin shell. The scale height is much smaller than the radius of the white dwarf, so you can't depend on it being able to expand like that. In this case, it's purely just a competition between heating and cooling, whether your temperature dependency or burning can beat out the temperature dependency or cooling or not. So naively, what you want is just to be the temperature dependence of the burning to be less than T to the 4, because that's how your luminosity goes. But the cold CNO cycle goes like T to the 10, so clearly something's missing. What you need to take into account is the effect of the density perturbation, particularly. So let's imagine that you're doing a constant pressure perturbation, very thin shell. What happens when you perturb the temperature? What happens to the density? Well, so let's imagine you just have ideal gas. So if your temperature goes up and your pressure is constant, your density drops, right, clearly. If your radiation pressure dominated, if your temperature increases a little bit, this term goes up. If you're dominated by radiation pressure, you have very little gas pressure to start with. And so your density has to drop much more to counteract this increase in radiation pressure. Okay. So radiation pressure is very important because that way you can get a very large density drop for a small temperature increase. And that will quench your burning because your burning rate is proportional to your density. And then if you include the pressure perturbation as well, that just makes it even more drastic. So density drops even more. So that's how you can get, you know, instead of T to the 10 dependence, you can get a T to the 4 dependence. All right, so now all the physics is in hand, and now we can just, this is the range of stable accretion rates between the two solid lines. I took out the gravothermal specific heat line. So the minimum accretion rate, this is where your thin shell and you just want your cooling to beat out your burning. Also plotted is equivalent bounds from Nomoto's work, numerical work. And you can see that it's not quite the same. I mean, it's, you know, pretty good, and we get the trends right, and we get this constant factor of 3 right, but the numbers aren't quite the same, and I think that's due to our approximation of the burning layer as a scale height, which isn't true. It's smaller. Do you have a question, Ken?
Previously, when we were talking about the radiation, these thin disks, or these thin shells, sorry, are they still thick enough that they're optically thick?
Are they optically thick?
Yeah.
Yes.
Thick,
yeah, this isn't the photosphere, if that's what you're asking. Okay, so there's this, you know, pretty constant factor of 3 between the maximum and the minimum. Why is that? Well, I don't want to go through the algebra, but you can just solve for it analytically for the ratio of the two accretion rates. You just have to assume that the burning goes, the cold CNO cycle goes like T to the 10, and because of that, there isn't much change in the temperature between the top and the bottom. So you can just solve for it and obtain this, in expanded orders of beta at the minimum boundary. And it's a pretty robust result. You know, you can't really get around this fact. Okay. So how on earth did Starfield do this? Because his stable accretion rate for 1.35 is down here somewhere. It's in the middle of this equation. Okay. So this whole range is stable for him. You know, what's going on? So the first thing we considered was the effects of a hot white dwarf. Okay. So let's do this little thought experiment in your head. If you have a very hot white dwarf, such that the luminosity is, you know, swamping your burning luminosity, well, the envelope could care less that there's burning going on because the thermal conditions are purely set by the core luminosity. So in that case, you know, any temperature perturbation will be stable because you're not going to get an increase in burning. So, you know, naively what you want is for the luminosity from the core to be of order, the burning luminosity, so your m dot times how much energy you get from burning it. And that's in this region over here, okay? Oh, so I should probably explain this plot. Let's just look at the solar metallicity line. This curve here demarcates between the stability and instability boundary. So inside this space, it's unstable. So if you don't have much luminosity, you're unstable. So let's just think of the limit where you don't have any luminosity, and you just have this strip here, right here, being stable. That's your narrow range of accretion rates. As you increase the accretion rate, you can be stable in this area as well. The problem is, okay, this seems great, but the problem is you can't have, you know, an arbitrarily high amount of core luminosity forever. At some point, your white dwarf is cooling, you know, it's not an infinite source of heat. So, kind of logically, the best you could hope for to heat your hydrogen layer is just the burning from the helium layer below it. And that has its own problems because helium, you know, is also prone to ignition. That's how you get type 1 X-ray bursts on neutron stars. But let's pretend, for, you know, the sake of simplicity, that you're burning that helium stably. Okay, and this is the maximum luminosity you could hope to get out of that. You can see that, you know, this isn't really going to help. Here it's minimum accretion rate of 3 by 10 to the minus 7. And here, if you can, you know, get that luminosity out, you're getting 2.7 or something by 10 to the minus 7. So you've lowered your accretion rate, minimum accretion rate, a little bit, but it's not very much. It's certainly not down to 10 to the minus 9 solar masses per year. Starfield's luminosity was something like 10 to the 35, so it's over here somewhere. It's definitely within this instability boundary, so that's not going to help. And even if that were helping, you wouldn't be able to maintain it for long enough to accrete enough mass to get up to the Chandrasekhar mass. So it wasn't the hot white dwarf, is the point. What else could it have been? Well, he also included a full nuclear reaction network. And why might that be helpful? Well, if you get hot and dense enough, you're no longer rate limited by your proton capture here, because the proton captures are happening nearly instantaneously if it's hot and dense enough. In that case, you become limited by the beta decays, because it's weaker interaction physics, doesn't care about temperature and density. So there's some constants. So in this limit, your energy generation is just some constant. It's temperature independent, so you can do whatever you want to the temperature. You're not going to get more burning out of it. Okay, so that's what we're hoping for. And this is how hydrogen burns on neutron stars, and that's why you don't have hydrogen ignitions on neutron star surfaces, because it's so hot and dense, it's just stable burning. Instead, it's the helium that ignites. So what do we have to do such that these will start to matter in our energy generation rate? Well, this is the steady state plot from before, and you can see that for this most massive white dwarf, the 1.35, and the really low metallicity, it was starting to bump up into this hot CNO regime. And why is that? Well, the more gravity you have, the more layer you can accumulate on top. And so that was just, you know, larger column means higher temperature, higher density. The lower your metallicity is, the fewer nuclei you have to be the catalysts for this cycle. So since there are fewer nuclei, you have to burn hotter and faster so to get the same equivalent energy generation out. Okay, so we can just do the same exercise, but now with a full CNO network with all these reactions in, and you know, you can solve for the equilibrium abundances and et cetera, et cetera. And it's fun. You can try it for yourself. Don't though. And so here's what you get. Okay. So these thin solid lines are the same upper bounds of the hydrostatic equilibrium for different metallicities, and these thick ones are now the new minimum accretion rates. So on the left side, you're still doing cold CNO burning. You're not at a high enough gravity, even though your metallicity is, you know, crazy low. You're still not at a high enough gravity to get the full CNO cycle into action. Okay, but it does change just because you have lower metallicity, and remember that makes you burn hotter and denser. And the temperature dependence of the CNO cycle is also itself temperature dependent. So the higher temperature is, the smaller that exponent is. But there's still this factor of three, and that's just, you know, it's the way the physics works, the way the math works out. It's just a robust result. You can't get around it. For the higher gravity cases, you can see definitely that the hot CNO cycle matters. So those beta decays are making your burning rate stable. And you can see that for the lower the metallicity is, the less gravity you need to make it matter. But this is still a moot point, because even for 10 to the minus 2 solar metallicity, you need to go all the way down here before you get any sort of useful parameter space opening up. Now, these, you know, maybe exist, fine, but these certainly don't exist or aren't going to be useful. They're not going to change the way the progenitor rates work out. So this isn't going to be useful for that. And that's kind of where the results stand. Hopefully what you can take away from this is just how you get stability. The upper bound is you can't go above it because of hydrostatic equilibrium. Right below it, your thick shell. So you put in heat, you get more expansion work, and you get a drop in terminal energy. Below that, thin shell stability, you just need burning to not be as strong as cooling. And the physics gives you that factor of three. If you have a very hot white dwarf, that can help it stabilize, but you can't get enough heat for long enough to make that useful for you. Okay. The hot CNO can stabilize your burning rate just like on neutron stars, but since we don't have a high gravity like neutron stars, we need a very low metallicity, and that's not going to happen either. Yeah, I'll post it this afternoon, and thanks to Lars and Tony Pyres and Berkeley.
Okay, we have time for questions.
There was, right after this Harman paper came out, there was a paper by Nemoto saying why it...
Right, so what Nemoto eventually said, this was last year, he came out and said that
there was not enough resolution.
Exactly. The envelope mass binning that Starfield used was just too high. I haven't been at the conferences with Starfield or not, but Lars has relayed to me that he wasn't sure, definitely sure, that that was the reason. And he was still trying to argue a little bit. But Nemoto's result was pretty, you know, it was pretty convincing, I think. But I don't know, I don't want to...
I thought so, too.
It's more of a comment. It occurred to me as you were speaking, and I hadn't thought about it before, that if in fact it was true that you could extend steady nuclear burning or quasi-steady nuclear burning with these lower values of m dot, that means that there's a much broader range of binaries, creating, you know, white dwarfs and binaries, where you would have quasi-steady nuclear burning going on, and we would therefore be able to see them closer to the Earth. The total number of quasi-steady nuclear burners in our galaxy may be on the order of 1,000 in the old model, but it really can happen at these lower M dots, then that extends it to a whole range of binaries that we didn't think of as having this process going on. Mm-hmm. Therefore, given the larger number of them, the nearest ones will be quite close to us, and we should be seeing them. So I'm not sure what we need to quantify it, but I think one might be able to make an empirical argument that the lower rates could be excluded because we just don't see the system. One needs to be careful about that, but it just...
But haven't people made some inferences along those lines from the white dwarf mass distribution and CVs? I don't remember the thought, but that's how you...
Mm, what was your opinion?
Well, that there aren't enough high mass white dwarfs in CVs.
I think that's
roughly what you meant.
Right. But of course, in many CVs, the M dot is even lower.
No, of course.
So,
but those are
right. This would essentially be, this would be a reach of the parameter space that we haven't really very well explored.
This is probably the reason there's no high, not enough high mass white dwarf, because they don't work. Study the nature of the mass.
Right.
So,
go ahead.
Near the accretion rate where you have the transition from unstable to stable burning, it has to be that the growth time scale is on the order of the accretion time scale. Mm-hmm. It's in some range.
Exactly.
Do you have a feel for that range?
Right. And so I can. What you're saying is, you know, in that case, if the perturbation time scale is longer than the accretion time scale, then any sort of perturbation I might have would just get vected out, something along those lines. So it'd be stable even though, right?
Or you could have some, it could be unstable, but not catastrophic, like a...
Right. Well, so, you know, I was worried about that too, but just doing the calculations, I can, I trust my calculations down to where the perturbation time scale equals the accretion time scale. And it just so happens that it's almost, you know, it's almost right on the accretion line. So there's not, that wouldn't help.
So there's no in-between. There's no sort of stable, burping, oscillating. I mean, you've done these steady solutions and you've perturbed them slightly, but are there any large amplitude perturbations or in-between things?
Right, so there's an imaginary part to the perturbation time scale that comes in there. So yes, I think there will be oscillations. And there was a paper, maybe mid-90s, by Kowaler, I think. But there's been work done on that, and there will be oscillations. And I'm not sure whether, like, how observable they would be.
You're saying that range of accretion rates must be very small, over which you could have some oscillations. I don't think you would see your oscillations in your equations, because you have only one. You have only the temperature equation that you're perturbing. But regardless, if you're going to see oscillations, the growth rate would have to be long, right? And you're saying that that range of accretion rates over which the growth rate is long is very small.
There is also, on top, you know, there's the real part of the perturbation time, so there's also the imaginary part.
Well, if you're perturbing only one equation, it's going to be purely real.
Right? Yes.
So. But.
Yes, yeah.
But if you had, you know, a more complete set of equations, still, I think this is your answer. The real part won't change that much. But you're saying, well, the range of accretion rates over which you could possibly see oscillations is very small. And so a more complete dynamical system may produce oscillations, but you essentially wouldn't see them. I think, you know, that's what you would find. That's my guess. From what you're telling me.
Okay.
I'm not sure that the zoning is completely the solution, because in the Starfield et al. Paper, they took the zoning down to 10 to the minus 7 solar masses in several cases and still got the same results. So claiming that it's strictly crappy zoning,
I don't think it's a complete answer. It may be part of it.
Okay.
Just a comment.
So how does the binary companion know that it's supposed to only send the right amount of stuff as a whiteboard?
Right, exactly. Well, it doesn't. If it does it too low, that's how you get
So, you know, below
this minimum accretion rate, you're going to get novae of some sort, current novae or classical novae. Above it, it's not really certain. There's a paper, there's some work done by Hachisu and Kato and Moto et al. That argues for the super hydrostatic equilibrium accretion will just drive a strong wind that somehow knows to blow off enough mass to allow for the rest of it to come on. I didn't see how that was explained. It seems plausible, but I didn't see the evidence for it. That doesn't mean that's not true.
But it's a fundamental ingredient in many binary system calculations that are used in high binary system consensus population. I mean, without that, basically the whiteboard pops up, turns into a red giant, and you have a common envelope.
Right.
But we see a system in the Magellanic Clouds, which clearly you probably know about it, that apparently is at the upper limit or just above the upper limit of this range. And so from time to time you see it as a supersoft, and then suddenly the X-rays go down, and it's down for a couple of weeks or months, and during that time it's optically very bright. So apparently then it pours out its energy in the optical wave, but it still keeps burning. So it flip-flops. And one has the impression that if you are above that range, maybe it comes out in the optical, but it does not become a red giant. That's why it does not look like that.
That's the RXJ,
Rosa's source.
There was a scenario in your paper, the 1992 paper, where you talked about this issue of what happens when it goes so high, right? And so it's true, this one doesn't seem to be a giant, but you did put forward the hypothesis that it was possible that at the time when the accretion rate becomes too high, that the white dwarf will pop up, and not exactly become a giant, it would just fill its Roche lobe, so whatever that corresponds to.
Well, there is no room for a giant in that binary.
That's right, so it wouldn't become a giant.
What you see are these jets, of course, which have, 4,000 kilometers a second, so the white dwarf probably has a disk also, and ejects matter in the form of a jet.
The science, though, behind that was a very, very interesting suggestion. What is your feeling right now about that scenario? Do you think that scenario is still a realistic scenario?
Yeah, well, whether you call it a wind or something, the matter has to go somewhere because it is it's above the Eddington limit, I suppose. It has to blow the matter on in some way.
Well,
there is no room for a giant.
Once you get up to those high
end jets, there are jets observed from symbiotics, from Novi.
There are jets from these systems, but the interesting thing is that once you get up to this value of M dot where you're no longer able to burn the material, generally the reason you're in that regime is because the donor is a little too massive for this to really be stable mass transfer. So the result is going to be either there's an instability in the mass transfer itself, and then you end up with the common envelope and this whole thing is cut off, or there's some way to get rid of the mass, in which case you eject it and stabilize the mass transfer at the same time you're able to make the material. Or you have to somehow turn off mass transfer for a little while, which is basically what the other thing you had hypothesized.
Yeah, we saw that that time maybe you turn the mass transfer off, but if I look at that system, it certainly doesn't do that. The mass transfer is going on and something the white dwarf isn't.
No, certainly that's true, but maybe the theory is more powerful. Maybe it's making some prediction for things we haven't seen yet.
Oh, yeah. I think we have to think about the theory.
So, Tony, in your case, what happens in the lower M dots? So it's not stable burning, so what is it?
So it depends on the accretion rate and the mass of the white dwarf. But
let's say 10 to the minus 9 and 1.2 solar masses.
Let me just run it in my head. at some point,
so it's just unstable burning. Is that the point?
Right. So you'll build up a pile and it'll flash off. And whether or not it's strong enough to inject matter or not, I don't
that's
think it depends on the parameters and whether or not it's really strong and will excavate matter.
Okay. So. Then maybe what we've shown is by stable burning, you can't grow it to the Chandrasekhar mass.
Could make
sense. Right. But by an unstable burning mechanism, still it's possible.
Oh, I'm not saying that's not possible, no. So if the flash is not strong enough.
Careful. Good.
It depends on whether the mass is retained by.
Exactly. It depends whether you're able to check.
But that's a whole other question.
Right. That's not stable.
It's just that's not stable burn.
Right.
But then in the binary, you come to another issue, right? Because in the binary evolution now, you say, okay, we have a system that has a fairly low m-dot. Well, it has a fairly low m-dot because the mass of the donor may not be as large. So then there's the question, is there a large enough reservoir of mass ready to be transferred to be able to get it up to the Chandrasekhar mass? So that's a different element of the reasoning, but nevertheless, it sort of goes along as these two things go together. So for some of the lower M dot systems, there just isn't a possibility. Not for all of them. For some of them, it is possible. But certainly for some of them, there just isn't a large enough reservoir there that could potentially be transferred.
Now, Kim, this paper has been refereed, you're going to put it on an SRPH. That means you don't have to think about it anymore. So what are you going to do next?
I'm going to Disneyland. I'm working, Lars is looking at some ANCB, and he's putting on the ANCB on paper. So. But more Novae stuff.
Yeah. Okay, good. Are there other questions? If not, let's thank Kim again. Fun.